You're listening to In Motion, a Masters of the Stage podcast. In Motion is a series of interviews dedicated to the voices of America's leading stage choreographers.
Hello, and welcome to SDC Foundation's In Motion with Wendy Seib. I am here with Camille A. Brown today. Hello, Camille.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us. You are our second installment.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I'd like to read a little bit of Camille's amazing bio here. She is a Ford Foundation Art Change Fellow, Aldelco Award recipient, four-time Princess Grace Award winner, Guggenheim Fellow, Jacob's Pillow Dance Award recipient, USAJ Frankie and David Harrow Fellow, TED Fellow, and Doris Duke Artist Award recipient. Her company, Camille A. Brown and Dancers, is currently touring the Bessie Award-winning Mr. Tall E. Rance, Bessie-nominated Black Girl Linguistic Play, and critically acclaimed Ink. Her community engagement platform, Everybody Move, inspires collective action through social dance and initiatives, Black Girl Spectrum, Black Men Moving, and The Gathering. Her notable theater credits include Tony Award-winning Broadway Revival, Once on This Island, Drama Desk, Outer Critics, and Cheetah Rivera nominations, Emmy Award-winning Jesus Christ Superstar Live on NBC, Broadway's A Streetcar Named Desire, The Fortress of Solitude, Lortel nomination, Bella, An American Tall Tale, Lortel nomination, among others. Her TED Ed Talk, A Visual History of Social Dance in 25 Moves, has over 15 million views on Facebook, and her company's performance of New Second Line at the TED Conference 2018 is now on TED.com. She's a graduate of LaGuardia High School of the Performing Arts, and she has a BFA from UNC School of the Arts. Ms. Brown is a choreographer for the upcoming Magic Mike the Musical, Pal Joey, and is movement director for Broadway's Choir Boy and Tony Stone. Whew! And that's the short version. Well, again, thank you, Camille, so much for joining us today. I know you have a very busy schedule.
Thank you.
It means
a lot. I
appreciate
this. Thank you.
So, again, sort of the series that we're looking at, as most of you know, is choreographers who move through different mediums, from concert dance to theater, sort of the main focus. We've also done, choreographers also dabble into film and TV and all that great stuff. So what I'd love to do is just sort of give a little taste of, I know it's sort of a long story, I'm sure, what brought you here, sort of what brought your way into dance and choreography.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'll start with the fact that I have a small voice, and I've always had a very small voice. And because of that, I would get teased a lot when I was younger. So speaking as a form of self-expression was not the first thing that I felt comfortable doing. I rarely participated in school in terms, because I didn't want to raise my hand and my voice be heard and someone tease me again. So movement was something that I found an immediate connection to, and it was really a safe space. And my mother also loved musical theater. She still loves it. And she would, well, at the time, before the internet, we would go, every weekend we would go to the library and take out our favorite musicals, and we would just watch the dance scenes over and over again. So the love of musical theater has always been there from the beginning, as far as I can remember. And then just in terms of watching Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson videos, I mean, that was at the height where videos and movement and dance was something that was everybody was really into. So I remember Michael Jackson's videos would air on like NBC at 8 p.m. and it was like a big deal, and you had to make sure you watched it because that was what people were going to talk about the next day in school. And then also just trying to find ways of injecting movement in everything that I did. So even watching cartoons, I would start making up dance routines to the opening credits for the cartoons, which is kind of silly, but that's what I did.
I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, and I also played with Legos. That was something that I love, and just kind of looking at how I used to play Legos, how I still play Legos sometimes when I need to not be stressed, and then also looking at how my process is now, I do see a connection between how I work, because when I was playing Legos and when I do play Legos, I'm always changing things and trying to figure out, well, what's the best way to do this? And I feel like that's very much how I approach my choreography, taking a shape and a structure and then redesigning it and constantly working on it until I feel like it's the best iteration of what it is. So that's pretty much how I got into dance. My mom saw that I loved this idea of movement, and she put me in dance school. And she put me in it was called the 3-6, and it was at Bernice Johnson, which is a school in Jamaica, Queens, where I'm originally from. And we took ballet, tap, and African, I believe, and we can only take up to 3. And my mom only put me in 1 the first year because she thought she didn't want to put too much on me. But she said, I looked so disappointed after the first class when it was time for me to go and everyone else went to their next class. She was like, oh no, okay. So the next year she put me in all 3. And that's pretty much how I started with movement. I didn't necessarily know that it was something that I could do for a living, because in school they teach you teacher, doctor, lawyer, you know, you have those main things that you're supposed to focus on. But I wanted to be a dancer. And it wasn't until I got to LaGuardia High School and I went to the Ailey School that I started really being around, like, obviously the Ailey dancers were there, and I thought, wow, I can do what I love every day and get paid for it and travel around the world. That's amazing. Whoa. So I had this love, but as I got older and started into like high school and started maturing, there was also a struggle that was added to it because I wasn't necessarily considered to have the ideal body. And people look at me and go, oh my God, but you're so small. How could people listen? People focus on body issues in terms of like the ballet world, but I don't think people realize that it is the same thing. You get the same type of pressure happens in modern dance.
Yep.
And you get put on diets, and that was what my student life was. It was part of every time we had a at the end of the semester or even before, I knew I was going to get sent to the nutritionist and put on diets. And I mean, that's all I can think of. So I had, even though I had this love for dance, I also had this fear that I wasn't going to become what I wanted to because of all of these other struggles that I had in my way. And I never really, I had teachers who focused on me and cared about me as a dancer in the body. And then I also had teachers that I could see looked at me and said, well, she's not going to be a dancer, and never looked at me again. Now, they didn't say that, but you feel it.
You know,
it's almost like, you know who's the favorite in the class. Like, you right. you know who they're looking at, and it's like, oh, they're going to make it, they're not going to make it. And I felt like there were so many spaces where I felt like, oh, I'm not who they see as being someone that could actually do this. So that was really hard for me to have to do. So I was constantly like working hard. Like I remember I felt like I was so behind when I went to LaGuardia, and I went to the Ailey School. So LaGuardia, you take modern and ballet, and then after school I would go to Ailey and take modern and ballet again. So I was taking 2 ballet and 2 modern classes, and then I took an extra class on top of that because I was trying to like catch up.
Right.
I just felt like I was behind. Okay, they're telling me I'm not good, so I just have to work and work and work until I can catch up to everybody. So there was a little bit of that as well. Didn't focus on choreography. I mean, back when I was a child, when I was making up stuff, I didn't really connect that to the fact that, oh, that can actually be something that I could also do. Because one of the things that, even in the world of dance, choreography wasn't something that I necessarily knew was for me.
I don't feel like they also like push you like you're going to be a choreographer. It's always dancer, dancer, dancer,
it's
dancer.
Always dancer, yeah.
Yes.
For you to dance for someone else.
Right.
And that is the height of achievement, getting into someone else's company.
Correct.
So that's what my focus was.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to college, I thought it was going to be, you know, a brand new day, like, oh, yes, okay, I don't need to think about my struggles because this is going to be a new day, a new school. And no, that was not the case. I got sent right back to the nutritionist. It was the same thing again. And freshmen at the time weren't able to perform. Like, that was a rule. But we could do, like, little shows here and there. And then sophomore year, sometimes you would get called to audition for the things. I didn't even get called to audition sometimes. And I remember going up to the call board, you know, they list the people mm-hmm. who are chosen. I just remember staring there so many times and, you know, hearing everybody like, oh my God, I got in. And it's just like, okay, how am I gonna walk away without crying my eyes out and everybody seeing me? So I had a lot of those things. And like my freshman year, when I realized that I was going to have to deal with a lot of stuff that I was dealing with before, I told my mom, you know, I wanted to transfer. I said, I don't think this is the place for me. And I just felt rejected. And she said, okay, well, you just got there. So, I don't want to pull you out now. And I think that you need to take this semester to figure out if this is something that you really want to do, and if so, what are the other schools that you want to look at, and then two, in the meantime, find something that helps you get through this semester. And before she said that, I'd never looked at composition and improv as something that I needed, because it just seemed weird. I mean, in all of my studies and all of rehearsals, I was always asked to do something that someone else showed me. And in comp class, Trish Casey, who was my first composition teacher at NCSA, she was asking us to make up language based on our voices. And I remember one of the assignments we had was we were going around in a circle and each of us had to do a shape or a movement that described who we were. And I just thought that was hard, and I felt really embarrassed, and I didn't know what to do. And so once my mom said that to me, for some reason, I automatically focused on composition improv and realized that, wow, this is really an opportunity for me to create my own voice. Even if nobody else sees it, this is my space. Even if it just means after class, you just move around the way you want to, and that's helping you get to the next day and take the stress away. So I really got into my composition and improv, and my teacher started seeing that, and I started submitting for the side shows that we did. And that was really great. And maybe like my junior or senior year, like my body started changing, and I started actually being able to work with other choreographers, which was great, because I got to do a Lara Lubavitch piece and a Twyla Tharp piece, and I mean, it was really awesome. And the thing that I love is that along with that, I was able to carry my love for choreography into that space as well. So I really learned to appreciate what composition and improv was. Once I graduated, I immediately went back into dance mode because, again, I was not conditioned to think past, oh, okay, this is composition improv, but never, you can actually be a choreographer.
That's a whole other level. It's a whole other job that you can do. Yeah.
But
it never, isn't that funny?
No, it just, you know, the focus was get into someone else's company.
Right.
And I remember people having very, as students, some of my friends having very specific choreographers that they wanted to work with. And I can't say that I ever had that until a friend of mine showed me Grace, that Ron Brown choreographed for the Ailey Company. And I saw that piece and I was just like, I want to work with him. I want to do that movement. That just feels like something I want to dive into. And I didn't know Ron had a company. So, and my friends asked me, because I never auditioned for Ailey, and they're like, oh, you never wanted to be an Ailey? And it's not that I never wanted to be an Ailey. I was just never conditioned to think that that was something that I should make a goal, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So coming out of school, that wasn't even like an option, because I was like, well, I went to the school and I already felt like I wasn't, you know, in that lineage. So let me just look at something else. So I was at the audition. I was at an audition. I graduated in June. I was at an audition for The Lion King. I was wrapped around the corner. And I was waiting on the line, and I ran into one of Ron's male dancers. And he told me that Ron was looking for a woman to join the company. And he said, oh, you should connect with him. And I had met Ron through the Ailey School, through people there a couple of times before. And he was teaching at Perry Dance. And someone suggested, oh, you should contact him and say you're interested and go take the class. So I did, and I stood in the back. I said, I am not going to play myself, because Ron's movement is a combination of like West African and modern dance, and I was doing for 4 years Cunningham, Lamone, and Taylor. So even though I had African dance training when I was younger, it had been a couple of years since I had really done it. So I was like, I'm not about to walk up in here and stand in the front and play myself looking crazy. So I went to the back and I, you know, did the best I could, and I thanked him afterwards. And I came back the next day, said, thanked him afterwards again, and he invited me into rehearsal, and said, okay, didn't expect anything, and I just tried to do my best. And he has this initiation, I don't know if he does it anymore, but he would give you a t-shirt, and it said evidence, and that's your way of being accepted into the company. So after maybe the second day of rehearsal, he hands me a t-shirt, and I was like, I don't know what this is. You know, should I don't know how to react to this. You know, is this like a going away party? I don't know what, you know. So everyone's like, oh no, that's his way of like saying you're in the company. So that was really wonderful. And his movement just felt like home, and it was so spiritual and really grounding for me. And it really reconnected me with the African tradition and culture and spirit, and it was just nice to not feel like I was a visitor somewhere, and felt like this is my community. And that's how I felt being in the company and being with the dancers and Ron. And maybe a year, so I graduated in 2001, got into the company September 2001, and so I was there for a year. I was in the company for maybe a year, and a friend of mine, Amy Page, who is my costume designer now, we were in the same class at NCSA, and she sends me a letter. Now, there's no internet and stuff like that, so she sends me a letter in the mail, and it's the Hubbard Street 2 flyer, and she says, you know, I think you'd really be good. And I hadn't spoken to Amy in a year, and I just felt really moved and honored that she thought enough to do this amount of work to send that to me. So I put my senior solo, senior group work that I did together, submitted it, and actually got it. And I thought, okay, maybe this is something that I should think about doing.
As a choreographer?
As a choreographer.
Oh, great.
Yeah, okay. So yeah. I put, sorry, I wasn't clear about that.
Okay.
So I submitted my stuff. And I was able to do that, and I thought, okay, well, maybe this is maybe a sign that this is something that I should also consider along with being a dancer, because I was in evidence for 5 seasons, so I was definitely like committed and rooted there. But I also thought maybe I need to take an alias, because you know how writers, like female writers, would take aliases, and I thought, maybe I need to take an alias, because the people that I see that are successful are male choreographers. And I don't know if I'm going to get the same kind of chance or opportunities that male choreographers have. So I'm going to make an alias. And then I thought, okay, well, this is completely different than writing, because you can kind of hide yourself. But in choreography, people have to see you.
Yeah.
So you can't do that. So I said, okay, well, if you're going to do this, then you have to be really clear that it's a uneven playing field, and you have to know that going in. So that's what I did, and I started submitting my stuff to festivals in the area of New York City, and then also while I was on tour with Evidence, people were interested in what I was doing, not necessarily outside of Evidence, but along with being a part of the company. And then word started getting out that I was also into choreography, and that's pretty much in a very long response. That is pretty much how I got into choreography.
Sure.
How I got into musical theater, I've always loved it, but I immediately went to the concert dance track because I wanted to be a dancer. But the musical theater bug was always there because every piece that I've done has had an element of theatricality to it. And so maybe around 2010, like 9 or 10, I thought, well, maybe I could have a shot or at least try to do something in theater. And I said, well, I have no idea how to do that because they're completely different worlds. Who am I going to talk to? I'm barely like doing stuff in concert dance. And excuse me, I was talking to Georgiana Pickett, who is executive director at the time of 651 Arts, and she'd also been following me as a dancer in Evidence and was interested in my choreography. And I was meeting with her, and she asked me what I wanted to do, like what were my long term goals. And I said, you know, I want to choreograph for theater, but I have no idea how to do that. And she said, well, why don't you just start speaking it into existence? So I did. So when people asked me what I was interested in doing, I also said musical theater. And then I got an email in 2011 from Daniel Aukin, who was the director of Fortress of Solitude, and he said he was interested in meeting with me about a project. I didn't realize it was a musical, and I met with him. Actually, he invited me to the reading, and I walked in, and I saw the music stands and the actors, and I was like, oh, this is a musical. So, oh my goodness, okay. But I also saw a couple of other choreographers that I knew were in theater too. And I said, oh, okay, so he's kind of interested in a couple of us, which he made very clear from the beginning. And I thought, okay, well, I have no theater experience, so I know I'm not going to get this. But I just thought, okay, well let me just definitely appreciate the opportunity and use this as, or look at this as a step in the right direction. And I met with him, and he told me that he wanted me to be the choreographer. And I thought, oh, wow, okay. And that meant a lot. It was him, Michael Friedman, who passed away last year, and Itamar Moses. And I have a very special place in my heart for the three of them because they did not have to do that, and they could have picked other people that had way more experience than I did, and I could have gone in and messed a whole lot of stuff up not knowing about the business, and there were so many times that I was just learning on the job, and they still kept me on the team, so I'm really thankful to them for that. And my the great thing about it was he said, I know that you don't have musical theater experience, but I definitely want your associate choreographer to have it. So we met with a couple of people, and Marco Santana was my associate choreographer for Fortress, and I learned a lot from him and really appreciative of his guidance really throughout that process.
Great. So my next question is just approaching a piece differently for concert as opposed to theater.
Mm-hmm.
What are those differences?
Yeah. Well, I look. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, yeah. Well, I look at it like this: when you're working in theater as a choreographer, you kind of have all of the elements in terms of a story and direction, and in concert dance, you don't have anything to start with. There is no story. You are the director. So there's a lot of building that I have to do. I mean, I have to do a certain amount of building in theater because you are building off of someone else's vision. But in concert dance, it's from the beginning. So for me, what is the story that I'm creating? What is the sound that I want to hear? What are the visual, if there are anything? So I'm building stuff up from the ground. I would say that's the difference in terms of the development. And what I've learned from theater is time and how precious it is. Because in concert dance, tech rehearsal at most on a good day is 4 hours, and that's it. And I'll never forget my first experience in a tech rehearsal in theater. And they did the first minute, and they said hold, and then we were sitting there for like an hour on one cue, and I was like, this is crazy. Why are we just sitting here? And then I thought, this is amazing. You can sit here and think, and you can actually think about a cue. And not only think about it, if it doesn't work, you can try like 8 other things and you have time to do it. This is amazing. And so I said, okay, I can't literally create a 12-hour day inside of concert dance, but I can control how I work and the time that I take to work. So around 2011, I was starting a new piece, Mr. Tolerance, and I knew that I wanted to severely shift the way I worked and thought about creation. And that was partly because I had worked with Diane McIntyre as a dancer. And I was blown away by her process, the way that she trusted her instincts, and you can see how she was thinking in real time, and you can witness like the ideas coming into her, and like her like having an aha and like responding, and just how she was communicating with her musicians and the other dancers. And I just thought, wow, this is the type of space that I want to create. So going back to my own work, I knew, okay, in order for you to have a process like that, you're going to have time. And also, you're going to need a company. Because before this, I didn't want a company. It was not the focus. I thought that I was going to be content choreographing for other companies and teaching. And when I started doing both, I realized that that was actually not what I wanted to do. It wasn't enough time for me. At most, you maybe get 4 weeks. And I think that that's a really good 8-count phrase to start with. So I just thought, okay, you're not putting yourself in a position to create at your best, to quote, you know, whatever, that's subjective, but like you want to give yourself the best chance you have at creating something solid that you feel good about. And I felt like doing commissions for other company was not putting me in that space. So I started pulling back on commissions. I haven't done a commission for another company since 2012, and I don't teach as often. I teach when we are on tour, but it's not something that like I'm teaching 3 weeks or teaching at a school. And I used to do those things, but I found that again, it wasn't something that I was really like wanting to do. Mm-hmm. So I started pulling back on that and just giving myself a year to 2 years to create one piece and figure it out and take the time to just hash out all the ideas. So then by the time you get on stage, or it comes on stage, regardless of whether people like it or not, you feel good about it. And so often when I was doing commissions, I didn't really feel good because I felt like, oh, I wish I had like 2 more weeks, or oh, I didn't really get a chance to like, oh, I wasn't really clear. And all of that stuff just kind of resolved itself once I created my own space. Mm-hmm. And I brought in people who really understood that I was trying to challenge myself, and I was also trying to challenge them too in a positive way, and just really understand what my movement language was, and to not be moved by my influences, because we're all influenced, but for me, I always want to make sure that my influences do not eclipse my actual voice. And I wanted to make sure, I wanted to give myself the time and the space to figure out what my voice was and to differentiate that between the influences. I don't know if that...
No, that's great. I was talking with Chase Brock last time.
Yeah, Chase.
I know. It's so great. And we were just talking about having this conversation and being like, oh, do we need to be more specific because it's two choreographers talking, so we kind of have an automatic education of things. And so what I always find in explaining is that in the theater world, the choreographer is still part of the storytelling, but they're part of the dance within the music, whereas a concert dance choreographer is the writer, the director, the producer, the choreographer. You know, a lot of people don't, I think, understand how different those are, although the element is still the same.
Yeah.
So in talking about the time, in theater, you know, you get in, you're like, here's an opening number, you got an hour and a half. And
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, hopefully you can do some pre-production, obviously.
Yeah.
Then in concert dance, it's almost as if you're writing the entire musical where you get all that time. And so the idea of time contracting and expanding in different parts of the different mediums is kind of fascinating. Yeah, and in tech and dance, you get... lucky 4 hours.
Yeah. And then it's interesting how looking at the creation of musicals, even though it is a very truncated amount of time once you get into the theater and then previews and stuff, but just in terms of the development, things take 5 years to put together.
Yeah.
And I know I don't have that type of time in concert dance, but just the amount of time people were giving and focus and energy to a project, I wanted to make sure that I did the same thing with my own work. And actually being a part of other teams in theater helps me be a better leader and director in my own company, because it's all about communication. And when you're working with actors, it's about communication. So everything is an experience and a lesson to help me be even more clear, more sensitive, more caring, loving, challenging with everything. So they're constantly ping-ponging off of each other.
Do you enjoy that?
I love it. I mean, it's extremely, it's a humble experience, because you go from being in charge, then you go for the next day, you're listening to someone else's vision, and that's your job to make sure their vision comes alive, you know? So, I mean, but I think it's great because I'm carrying other people's perspectives, and it's easy in concert dance for you to position yourself where you're not challenged. Because it's all guided by you. And so being in theater, because you can't do that, and everything is about the story. So you're winning and losing battles back and forth. Mm-hmm. And when I move into concert dance, it can't just change into, oh, well, I'm the director, so I'm going to win all these battles. It can't turn into that, because the story is still the most important part. So I can't use the fact that I'm now the director as an advantage. I still have to learn from the experiences of losing those battles and figure out within my own work, what are the steps that don't make sense, that even though I really love it and I think it's the best thing since sliced bread, does it have to do with the next transition? No, it has to come out.
Right. You still have to kill those babies.
You still have to do it. No, and I learned that in theater, because I thought, oh, when I go in musical theater, I do the job, and then I go away. No. Some things, no, you're telling the story, and you want to make sure that everything is in support of that story. And sometimes it means letting go of things that you really, really love and mourning.
Yep.
You know, mourning.
They say the composers have the trunk songs. I think we have like the drunk or drunk.
Mm.
The trunk movements.
Yeah.
Those trunk compositions of dance. You're like, oh, that'll go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah, that'll go somewhere else.
Yeah.
One story, Daniel Auchin, this was in Fortress, and something had to go that I did, and I don't think I hid my disappointment very well. And
well, it's emotional too.
You know, it's emotional. But I didn't know enough to like hide that,
you
know, or express it a little differently. So, you know, he was just talking to me and he said, you know, that's part of this business is that everything that you like is not always going to make it. And I said, wow, yeah, that's true. So from me having that conversation with him, I realized that, wow, this is really a collaboration. Mm-hmm. Everything goes hand in hand. And it's the same thing with concert. Once I learned that, it was helpful for me to be okay with being around other perspectives and working with dramaturgs and understanding the importance of that. And you know, whether you take their suggestions or not, or take other people's feedback, is one thing, but at least I'm leaving the space open to at least hear it. And then also looking at different directors and how they interact with the actors and how they interact with their other collaborators is just really, really, really powerful lessons for me to take into how I work with even my staff. Communication is just really key on every level, from artistic to administrative. It's at the heart of movement, but also how do you, as a leader, empower people? How do you challenge them, but how do you still have them walking out feeling that they are always contributing to the work and not taking away from it?
Yeah.
Or messing it up, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's the idea of the challenging everyone, but also feeling them elated and learned and moved and heard at the same time. But
yeah,
there's still a challenge to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but not hampering that down.
Right. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between then specifically working with actors as opposed to dancers?
It's the same for me. Intention, listening. I tell dancers that I think there's an incredible amount that we can learn from actors in terms of their choices, because that's choice making is really the thing that I'm inspired by. And I tell people that if you just give me the step, then I can't see the story. But if you have some type of intention, even if we haven't talked about what the piece is about, if there's meaning, then I have something to go with. So it's the same with any either one. And just looking at their bodies. And one of the things that I say to both are, it's too dancey. Meaning that I don't see, how would you, if you're waving hello to somebody, how would you do that for real? When I'm talking to a dancer and I tell them to wave, it's easy for us to go into the dance version of wave. And so part of that is going, okay, that's the dance version. How would you really do it? And then that's from there we start generating material. So it's almost like we build a phrase, and then we deconstruct the phrase and figure out, well, how would the human being, an everyday person, do this? Now we have to add an element of theatricality, so it's not literally going to be how somebody outside does it, but it has to be to the point where the person outside could look at you and go, oh, I've done that before. And I feel like that makes movement, that makes storytelling accessible. And it kind of takes away that wall that sometimes non-dancers feel when they are watching dance. And I think that's the beauty of social dance. And that's how I work with that. I use that formula to work with dancers and actors, because there's a certain amount of improvisation that both actors and dancers need, and that ability. So it's about giving both the structure, but also telling them, this is just not about me giving you the step. This is now about you putting your individuality into the work, because that's what lifts everything off the page to me. This could be a story of sadness, or it could be a story of joy, but the specificity is the thing that makes your joy different from the person next to you. And for me, that's how I can build a relationship between those two joys, or create division between those two joys. But I have something to build.
Of integrity.
Yeah.
That honesty.
Well, yeah. I tell people, if it's not a choice, like if you are just doing a choice because I told you to do the choice, don't make it. Because it's clear that it's not going to be an honest choice. I'd rather you just stand there and tell me I don't have anything versus like you make something up.
I usually say, so it looks like I'm doing what Wendy told me to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's do something else.
Yeah. And I tell both, it's like, I don't, dancers and actors, you know, when people see you on stage, I don't, even though people should definitely know it's choreographed, but they should see you and they should know that you are fully present in the idea and you know exactly what you're doing.
Agreed. You only have a few minutes left. Is there anything you'd like to say or leave with us?
I think listening is key. Really, that's how I've built my last two pieces specifically, because they are a lot of duets, mostly duets in all of them. So those duets came from the organic process that we had. So I didn't come in, I mean, I knew Black Girl Linguistic Play, like I knew that I wanted it to be about Black girls. I wanted to use play as a way to talk about childhood. But beyond that, I didn't know what we were gonna do. And it's about generating material that taps into our childhood, but it's also about the dancers that are in the space, especially when you're talking about duets. So Beatrice and Fauna had a duet, and the way they were interacting with each other outside of rehearsal was very older sister, younger sister. And so I decided to bring that type of energy into it and help build this story about these two sisters that are, and I found a connection with me, because it was also representing the relationship that I had with my cousin, because she's 6 years older than I am. So the big sister, younger sister, was something that I could relate with in terms of like being the younger one and being into playing, and then all of a sudden the older one hits puberty and starts like exploring and looking at boys and doing all this stuff, and then all of a sudden she doesn't want to play with me anymore. And me, as the little sister who hasn't quite hit puberty yet, is in this world of like confusion, because part of me feels a little rejected by it. And Beatrice has a younger brother, Fauna has a younger sister, so all of us have some type of connection in terms of like being the younger, being this. So we're also talking about things too. So I'm getting to hear their personal stories, and I'm getting to share my personal stories, and combined, we came up with that story of Black Girl. And the thing that I love about working in theater and concert dance is that both of them are constantly speaking to each other. So I got the idea for Black Girl from doing Fortress of Solitude. And there was the opening scene in Fortress where the protagonist goes back into his childhood, and it's like the 70s and 80s. And there were two Black girls who had to come on, and they had to have an entrance before they started singing their song. And I thought, okay, 70s, 80s, I grew up in the 80s, let's do a double dutch, because I used to do that. And they do this double dutch routine. And I thought, that's it. That's what I could do for Black Girl. I can use the idea of play and double dutch and use that as a springboard and build this whole work. And the same thing with Once on This Island and Ink, the last part of the trilogy that I created. Ink is about accessing gestural information and the African tradition, and also the African American experience and tradition too. And Once on This Island is about honoring West African, Afro-Cuban, Afro-Haitian. So it's all living within the same world. And that was exciting because I didn't, even though I had to split myself in terms of this is Once on This Island and this is Ink, in terms of the information, it was kind of both the African tradition was orbiting around both of them. So I'm using both to generate material that could be used in both. So some of the phrases that they're doing in Once on This Island, we're doing in Ink. And not identical because they're different stories, but you know, you're using these kind of like anchors. And even Choir Boy, when we're tapping into these Negro spirituals and this idea of, I was telling the guys that, you know, your young guys, this takes place today, but you're singing these Negro spirituals that, I mean, 19th century. So you're accessing this loaded history, but you're also telling us about who you are in the present day. And that's what Ink is about too. It's about accessing the past and how we use the past to inform our future. So Choir Boy and Ink are still orbiting the same. So I think it's really special that I have the opportunity to do that. And even like based on technicalities, where Once on This Island is in the round, and I had never done anything in the round. So I said, okay, I was working on one of the sections in Ink called Turf. And if you look at that duet, you'll notice that they're constantly like turning. And that's because I was practicing for Once on This Island. And so now people see that and go, you know, you should do Ink in the round. I'm like, yeah, I know. I didn't do it in the round. but you know, it's like things are working together. And they don't always align. But somehow they find themselves like Jesus Christ Superstar is about obviously Jesus and God and like spirituality. And I thought, okay, what kind of movement language can I use here or be inspired by? And I thought about the piece that I did in 2006 called New Second Line. And it's about second lining, which is a social dance in New Orleans. And it's all about, it's notably connected to funerals, but it's basically a celebration of someone's life. And you're honoring them, you're lifting them up. And I thought, wow, that's pretty much what they're doing in terms of Jesus Christ Superstar. Even though they don't get to the resurrection scene in the musical, it is still about worshiping and honoring someone. So a lot of the material from Second Line is in Jesus Christ Superstar. And then just listening to some of the musical selections that they use, I heard in What's the Buzz, I heard like this 90s kind of hip hop thing. So I use social dances from there. And King Herod song, it had a little bit of like 20s, kind of Charleston kind of thing, so I wanted to do a deconstruction of like what that was. But I'm always tapping into the world of like social dance wherever I go. Magic Mike is a little different. I have to say Magic Mike is a little different, but the thing with Magic Mike, I said, even though this is about stripping, it can't be about stripping. Because people are going to walk in knowing, oh, they're just going to take off their clothes and blah, blah, sorry. They're just gonna strip, and that's all there is. And I said, how exciting would it be for people to walk in expecting that, because of course that's what you want to see, but also getting something else. And I think part of looking at sexuality, I immediately connected it to, even though we're dealing with a different gender, I automatically connected it to Gypsy. And the idea of, like, back in the day, you just taking off one thing was amazing. And everybody went crazy. And there's a sophistication to stripping. There is an artistry there. So it's about pulling that. And the funny thing that I realize that I do when I'm having meetings with people is that I tell them the challenges. I don't tell them how confident I am, because normally I'm not. And because, you know, that's your moment where you're supposed to say, this is what I can bring to the project. And I have found what I do, I don't know if this is great, but I automatically say, well, these are the challenges that we're facing.
But I think that's probably helpful, because I'm sure they know those too.
Yeah, you know? and it's
and that you recognize them. That's important.
Yeah, I recognize this is the challenge. you know, and it's gonna be hard. And obviously, I'm like ready to dive in for the challenge. But I think it's also important to be honest about those things. Because that's what collaboration is too. Nothing is easy. I don't ever go into a piece thinking it's going to be easy. I think the day I feel comfortable is the day I should stop, because it should feel dangerous. And I guess the last thing I'll say is every time I start a new project, I completely freak out. Because I go, what if I can't do this? They asked me to do this thinking that I could do it, but what if I go in and I completely mess up or disappoint people? And when I was starting Once on This Island, I was talking to Diane McIntyre, and I told her, I said, oh my gosh, I'm so nervous. What if I walk in and I don't know what I'm doing? And she said, oh, don't worry, you'll be so busy, you won't even be thinking about it. And she was right. I freaked out before, and I freaked out after rehearsal, but during rehearsal, I was there. And the other thing, this is like another podcast episode probably, but I got really sick last year, and my appendix ruptured on tour.
Oh, gosh.
And I've had two surgeries this year. I just had my second surgery in April. And I've been in the hospital numerous times. And I actually was in the hospital the third day of rehearsal for Once on This Island. I was in the hospital for a week, and I was really nervous because that was the second. Well, okay, so my appendix ruptured, and it's different from appendicitis, where appendicitis is it's inflamed and they catch it right before. Mine actually burst.
Yeah.
And the fluid was in my system for at least a week. The doctors didn't know if it was like a week or two, but they said after 5 days it's fatal, so you technically should not be here. And I thought, oh wow, okay. So they said, well, now that it's healed, you know, now that it's done its damage and you've survived, we're gonna let it heal. And it did, but then it ruptured again. So the second time it ruptured was Once on This Island. So You know, I've always wanted to choreograph for Broadway, and there I am in the hospital crying my eyes out to my agent because I was like, they're going to let me go. They're going to let me go. I don't have a name, so, and I don't know how long I'm going to be in here, and I just was so upset because it's not fun when your body is not working with you. And thankfully, they waited for me, and I had an incredible choreography team with Ricky Tripp, who is my associate, and Catherine Foster, who is my assistant on the show, and Michael Arden and Ken Davenport were really generous. And but the surgeon, my surgeon, said I needed to have surgery within 6 weeks, and I said, well, I can't do that. We have a show. I have a premiere. My piece for my company was premiering the day before Once on This Island was opening, and that was at the Kennedy Center.
Jeez.
So I said, well, I can't do that. And he said, you have to, because you're going to be at risk again. So I had surgery the day of the first day of tech rehearsal for Once on This Island. And then I was able to work on the changes during previews. And the fun thing about being in the hospital is that you have a lot of time to think. So I had that time to figure out for me what in the movement worked and what didn't work. And we also had some space where I was working with my company, because we had rehearsal, and then there was like 2 or 3 weeks, and then we had our official rehearsal. But in the time that we had the 2 or 3 weeks break, I was touring with my company. I couldn't dance because I just got out of the hospital. But that was the time when I tried to, I think I set the opening number, like a draft of like the new opening number that I had for Once on This Island. And then when we came back, I started like redoing it and putting in my changes during previews. And then one of my incisions opened in January, and I went to the doctor, and I went to the doctor before I went to rehearsal for Jesus Christ Superstar, and he said, you're gonna have to have surgery again. And it took everything for me to walk in to that room and not feel completely defeated, because no one really knows. I mean, of course people knew I was in the hospital, but no one knew the severity of the situation. Right. And I had to wear big sweaters because my incision, it was like a whole big thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've heard about Core Rhythm Fitness. So I joined that program. One of the, Roderick Covington, who was in Once on This Island, he's one of the teachers. So after my second surgery, I joined that. And I joined that in my first performance. And I had been performing in and out, wasn't really doing it like full out because I couldn't. But that was like in August, was my first time after a year and a half that I felt really in my body and solid. And it's interesting because before I got sick, I was turning 37, or I turned 37, and I was like, oh, I'm getting old, I can't dance anymore, I gotta think about retiring. And it's interesting when you can't walk. You go from thinking, oh, I need to sit down, to the point of, I can't get up. So now that I'm out of that, looking ahead, it's all about enjoying the process. Because people ask me, oh, did you have fun? Do you have fun? And I do have fun on projects, but I was also dealing with like a life-threatening issue that entire year of Once on This Island and Jesus Christ. And my fear with Once on This Island was that people would see, you know how sometimes what you're personally going through has a way of like showing itself in your work. And that was my biggest fear, was that wow, everybody would see, it wouldn't be finished, it wouldn't be like a fleshed out thought, It would be all over the place because I was mm-hmm. trying to get through, and I don't think it looked like that, but those are the type of things that I was thinking about, and I was just working so hard to make sure that it didn't look like that, because I knew that one, nobody was gonna know, two, nobody cared. So you know, it's like, oh, you were in the hospital, that piece. And so so I knew and even like the dance magazine cover, like I had to wear a sweater because I was all bandaged up underneath, and like these are things that, like, you know, you go, if you only knew. And I'm working on writing a piece for a dance magazine about it, because I don't say anything about like my personal business online or anything like that. But I think it feels like I want to share, and it's such a part of my experience. And even though I haven't necessarily, like, when I was talking to you about Once in This Island, it's not until an hour later that I told you that I was in the hospital four times, you know. So, but even in my conversation with people, even if I don't go into my personal stuff, it's still there. Like, I'm still like, yeah, that's when you were in the hospital. Yeah, that's when you had an IV. Yeah, that's when you, like, and I had to do, like, IV infusion, like, three times a day at one point.
We're still people.
Yeah.
We're still people. We're artists, yeah. But we're still people. You still go through the things.
Yeah.
That everybody does, and it's never on the time it has to or would be better or
no.
And that's, you know, that's another level of difficulty I mm-hmm. feel like we face as artists.
Yeah.
And that you're not supposed to talk about it also
right.
too, which is, I think, unfortunate because we are people.
Mm-hmm.
And it does inform our art, you know.
And I didn't want to talk about it until I was out of it because I didn't want people to, you know, mm-hmm. now people are looking and like, oh, or not.
Pity.
Yeah. And it's like, mm-hmm. if you go to Once in This Island and you think it's good work, then that's it.
Done.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't want you to think, oh, that's good work for her being in the hospital three times. She did pretty good. You know, so.
Yeah.
And then I think I said the last thing like four times, but I think this is the last thing that I want to say. I'm really interested in directing and choreographing for theater. And the thing that I have found just looking, and I think it was the same reason why I was so hesitant about having my own company, is because when I was in Ron's company, I saw how much he had to do in terms of, he was the choreographer, he drove the cars, he wore so many hats. And when I look at directors, they wear so many hats. I mean, after midnight, when we have that meeting and I'm gone, the director is still there talking to all the other collaborators, and then I'm sure they're getting email after email. And it's tough. And just to talk, and then just to be done at 12:30 and then show up again at noon. So in the same way that I've put wanting to do theater into the atmosphere, I am starting to do that with directing and choreographing and really trying to be brave enough to say that that's what I want to do. And I was telling a friend, I don't know if I can do it. And they said, well, Camille, you technically already are doing it because you have your own company and you are directing. I was like, oh yeah, I am.
And now I have it on tape.
What?
What you just want to do now.
I know. Now it's there.
Now it's solid.
So I want to do that. So I'm excited. I'm nervous, and I feel like, you know, I want to do it, and I'm saying that hoping that I'm capable of doing it. And I want to at least try and give it a shot. And again, it's also something that being a Black female who is working in theater as a choreographer and now is trying to transition to being a director and a choreographer, there are not a lot of Black females that are doing that or have done that, but the ones that have done it, I'm really thankful that I can see the possibilities through them, and I hope that Black girls coming after me can see the possibilities through me. And that has nothing to do with whether they like the work a lot or not. It's just the fact that they know that I exist, and if they want to do this, it's possible for them to do it.
That's a lovely place to end our discussion.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Camille. This has been wonderful to learn more about you.
Thank
you. I appreciate all your stories.
Okay, I know I really talked a lot, right? It was like, okay. Be quiet.
It's like, no.
Like, this episode will be in two parts because she kept talking.
That's all right. Thank you so much for listening.
This podcast was brought to you by SDCF, Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation. SDCF acknowledges and extends a very special thanks to its 2018-2019 leading contributors, the David Lee Foundation, the Hargrove Pierce Foundation, the Oki Foundation, Trip Coleman, Sheldon Epps, Linda Hartzell, Doug Hughes, and Thomas Kale for their support this season. SDCF events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of career. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.